Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Florida continues to shatter daily records for coronavirus totals. The state registered 12,600 cases today. That's after adding 15,300 on Sunday. Sunday's total was the most by any state in the country since the start of the pandemic, thousands more than New York's peak back in April. The record comes as parts of the economy continue to reopen. Disney World began accepting patrons over the weekend under mask requirements and social distancing. Governor Ron DeSantis has said he doesn't plan to roll back the economy any further, but he is continuing with the shutdown of bars statewide. Democratic congressional leader Donna Shalala is calling for a two-week statewide stay-at-home order. Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez just held a press conference with public health leaders about the state of the pandemic here and did not mince words.
Contact tracing, testing, those are all tools. They're important. But the number one thing to reduce this virus and the level of contagion in this county, and actually probably in the country, is the way that we act and the precautions that we take as individuals. That's the number one way to reduce the virus.
The Miami Herald's David Neal joins us now. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is the Miami Herald's Doug Hanks. Doug, always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Doug, I want to start with you. I mean, talking about the mayor's press conference just a moment ago, how did the mayor respond to these numbers, especially in Miami-Dade over the weekend?
Well, I would say frustration. He blames the problem on people not following the rules he's imposed, which is now masks in public and social distancing when around people. He has linked the problem. He returns frequently to the protests of late May, as well as just a general sense that it isn't as serious as it is, and that's led to the spread.
How has his tone shifted over these last, half dozen press conferences?
I would say we've seen a couple shifts. First of all, he's definitely shifted when it comes to protests. In the beginning, he was very circumspect and said, well, we think it's a contributing factor, but we'll see. Now he's pretty adamant that it was a major factor. We haven't seen any data to connect this, but anyway. He has said, listen, I'm not ready to issue more business closures, but that's certainly on the table. Let's see what happens. So I would say his tone has definitely gotten more exasperated over the last 2 weeks.
And that's what he said. But, what have we heard from public health officials? They were also on the call. What are they saying about the cases?
Well, they're very grim and very grave. One doctor said essentially we're the new Wuhan and we're the epicenter of the pandemic, and hospitals are getting ready to be, they're under pressure, certainly getting full. And they back up the mayor saying we need a change in public behavior. And you even have the doctors saying they're reluctant to cause the economic pain that would come from more closures.
David, when do we typically see the higher counts of testing over the course of a week? Is it usual to see what we saw Sunday? I mean, it's a bit unbelievable.
That's Sunday is a day because of the way the data is entered and you have fewer people entering data, you have fewer people gathering data. It's sort of a clerical reason that Sundays usually are kind of the break in the trend. I think there were 3 weeks in a row where we had, new highs like two or three days in a row, and then boom, Sunday was slightly less. Now, that which is why I do the numbers or number stories on each Sunday. I compare Sunday to tend to compare Sunday to Sunday. And if you do that and look at those numbers, that's been jumping up the last 4 or 5 weeks in a row. But there was nothing indicating that we would see what, we saw yesterday. A large number of test results came in, and that's the spin that the governor's office is trying to put on it. Look at the positive test rate. It fell for the third straight day.
And that's, you know, the positivity rate. This is the metric that a lot of health experts want to point to. But yeah, has that been? I thought it was going up.
Well, it is. And look, a trend is, you know, people want to, if you're looking for the, you know, looking for the light at the end of the tunnel, people always are always looking for, okay, you know, they're looking for one day, 2 days. Okay, great. Okay, look, the positive rates went down today. But if you're talking trends, you have to go at least a week, 2 weeks. Well, three weeks ago, the average positive daily rate was, I believe, 9.94%, which is under 10%. It's not great, but it's still in the, you know, in the range that everybody would like their rates to be. The next week, and this is the state of Florida, the next week, the rate jumped up 46% from that 9.94 to 14.5%. That's not good. That's bad. That's a problem. And when it jumps and jumps that far. And then last week it was, for the week, 14.2%. That's a 2% difference. So you're talking virtually the same. I've likened it to, you know, over seven games, a running back runs for 700 yards, another running back runs for 686 yards. That's the difference you're talking with, a 2% difference. So you're talking virtually the same. So it kind of flatlined in that 14% range. Looking at the, you know, again, today, looking at the percentages, they kind of bumped back up again today. You know, again, one, you can't use one day, but again, it's saying that over the course of time, these rolling numbers are still not looking good. And no, they're not dropping over as a trend yet.
And the other thing too is looking at testing, David, I mean, has testing expanded in recent weeks, especially here in South Florida?
Well, yeah, there's a lot more testing being done, a lot more people being tested. And one of the things that's a little bit confusing is when they quote number of tests being done versus number of people tested. And for example, the governor's office yesterday quoted the number of test returns they had, like 142,000 test returns. The data that most outlets use off their dashboard day to day, and I try to be consistent about this, and we all at the Herald try to be consistent, always using the same data day to day, same source, is number of people tested. The number of people tested for the first time, that was at 99,003 yesterday. So yeah, it was a high number, but still, you can throw any, you know, low number, high number. If your positive hit rate is still at 11.25, that's still not good. That's above what you want it to be. So, you know, and again, that to me, that you look at the trend of positive hit rate, and you know, hospitalization trends are also something else you look at.
Right.
You know, right. So.
Yeah. Doug, there's been reporting on the backlog of tests for a number of private companies. What's the average wait time for a diagnostic test?
For the test, I mean, we're hearing a week plus, and yet Carlos Magoya today sound very frustrated and calling the testing system totally ineffective because of the lag, because really what value is knowing a week ago you either tested positive or negative. It certainly doesn't stop the spread of anything. So it maybe it's the number one problem right now when it comes to the government's response, is the inability to get people tested quickly.
And you mentioned Magoyas, he's the president of Jackson Health System, right?
Mm-hmm, correct. Yeah.
And Doug, you mentioned earlier one public health official compared what's happening to Florida to Wuhan, China. So what do they mean exactly in terms of the virus spread? Is the mortality rate as bad here as it was then?
No, I think just spread.
Just the spread.
If you look at our, like, we're very high up when it comes to per capita cases. And, you know, I'm sure you could analyze, you know, where Miami-Dade ranks relative to all these other problem places.
Right.
But, you know, this is serious, and the numbers are, there's no number out there that's good for Miami-Dade County when it comes to the spread. And this is what the administration was bracing for since the beginning. I mean, I remember someone very close to the mayor in March said to me, you know, New York is getting hit and we're next. And that turned out to be, you know, they were having a New York style spread. So that's what they're dealing with.
Right. And as you had mentioned, talking about the test, I mean, I can attest to that. What I don't know offhand is the company that did my test, but it was 5-6 days later. And I mean, it was great to get a negative back, but I didn't know. It was like in that 5 or 6 days, if that really meant anything. Again, I'm talking.
Right. And then did you get in the following 5 days? It's really not effective.
Right. No, I mean, it feels good to get that call and you get it, but then you're like, but 5 days have passed. What's happened to me since? And that's been bothersome, very bothersome. Again, I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Doug Hanks and the Miami Herald's David Neal. Again, Florida breaking the single-day record for any state in the United States Sunday with more than 15,000 recorded positive coronavirus tests. You can find David's story and Doug's reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And stay up to date, by the way, on our coverage of COVID-19 at WLRN.org. David, what have we seen in terms of hospitalizations? You mentioned it a second ago, you know, in South Florida, because I think Jimenez had mentioned it too. That's going up.
The hospitalizations have gone up 27 of the last 28 days, the current hospitalizations. The state was reporting, you know, hospitalizations daily right from the start, but unless you know if it was, you know, you didn't know how many of those people stayed one day, how many were there for 30 days. You know, so there really wasn't, you know, there wasn't much context for that number. Miami-Dade has been reporting for a while now current hospitalizations. Those have gone up 27 of the last 28 days in Miami-Dade. I think it's Doug's story reported on Friday. They, you know, crossed it was a week ago Friday. they crossed the 70% line with ICU bed usage, and now the last few days it's been they're 94%, 95%.
They're reaching capacity, but we also heard they can increase ICU spaces, right?
Yeah, they can, but and it looks like they're probably going to have to, the way things are going. As Doug said, there's not a single number that looks good for Miami-Dade County.
And Doug, the other thing too, because you had talked about, I mean, we heard from Baptist Health and Jackson Memorial during this press conference. What is the status of their PPE and their ventilators? You know, do they have the supplies?
I don't think we've heard about PPE shortages publicly like we were back in March, et cetera. I mean, I think that it's definitely a concern, but I know Magoya said recently that we really aren't particularly for March. And ventilators, when you look at the county figures, they still have quite a few available, more than 700.
Yeah, and what about nurses?
Well, see, the nurses we don't have stats on, but that's what you hear consistently from the hospitals is that, listen, we have like the physical space, but we don't have the staff. That's what's really under stress.
You know, with these cases going up, I mean, we had President Trump, you know, in South Florida, in Miami on Friday. He was at a news conference in Doral, where he launched a new Hispanic task force for his reelection campaign. Did he say anything about, David, did he say anything about the growing number of cases, how bad things were getting down here?
No. I mean, he stays on the message of, well, you're seeing more cases because we have more testing. We've done far more testing than anyone in the world, which is, you know, on a per capita basis, not true. You know, he stays on message, you know, very, very bluntly.
And while he was here, did he wear a mask?
He got off the plane not wearing a mask. I believe he donned a mask for the first time visiting a military hospital the other day. And, you know, they had a mask with the little presidential logo on it. I don't know if that's what they were waiting for yeah. him to start wearing one.
But, what about the governor? Has Governor DeSantis maintained his tone on keeping the economy going as it is and trying to, he's, again, the big push is we're reopening schools in August.
Yeah, he also has stayed completely on this is what we're doing. And now it seems like, you know, he's no matter what, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. I mean, this is a state that's economy is based on real estate and tourism. And, you know, it's hard to sell real estate, you know, in the middle of a pandemic hot zone, especially if everything you do as a government tells people it's not safe to be here. We've already seen the damage to tourism. And, you know, I think it's very obvious that, you know, the governor is reacting, you know, with, you know, looking at however you want to view it as being good or bad. He's reacting, you know, to the wallets and the bank accounts of Floridians. And, you know,
and what
the emails I get from, you know, the frantic emails I get after, you know, these big number stories. And Ben Connark, one who does healthcare for us, also kind of mentioned this on Twitter. It's funny how many of them come from realtors saying, no, it's not that bad. There's a virus just around, there's a vaccine just around the corner. Really?
Yeah. You know, the other thing, too, though, is this. I'm wondering because now there's been pressure for the governor to have a mandatory mask statewide, you know, mask order. But now we're hearing Congresswoman Shalala saying, you know what, there needs to be, you know, 2 weeks. Everybody just stay at home. This is getting bad.
Yeah, but that they don't want to reverse and go back into a lockdown again because for the economic damage that it would do. Again, you know, good or bad, that's they may not, you know, whether they say it or not, that's simply the reason they're not going to do it.
Yeah,
and they don't want to do it. Now, I've talked to a few infectious disease professionals who are upset that during the last lockdown, they did not take the time to kind of set up, you know, get the contact tracing settled, you know, get a good plan together for reopening. It was just kind of like they sat down and then hoped it would all go away. And they're not happy with either the local or the state leadership on that level.
And Doug, I mean, talking about rollback, I mean, has Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez given any indications that maybe we got to roll things back a little bit?
Yeah, he got pretty specific on that today. He said there is no plan right now to impose new business restrictions. He says it's on the table, and they want to see if what they've already done will start moving the numbers. You know, the numbers came out today. We didn't really see improvement in the positivity rate, but so we'll see where that goes over the next few days, right? Because that's probably a week lag in terms of how long it takes the test results to get back.
And what did he say about enforcement? Is there a need for more enforcement of businesses and individuals?
They're always saying there's a need for more enforcement, right? That's a constant message. And maybe at some point you can enforce your way out of it. But I would say their number one message, and the mayor's message was, listen, lots of talk, but really we just need to change people's behavior. But, you know, it's been a long time. I'm not really sure if more public calls are going to change behavior or if the changing circumstances will change behavior in terms of, you know, grim footage from hospitals or maybe opening the field hospital, something that kind of indicates, wow, we're in a different situation.
Yeah. I want to thank Miami Herald's Doug Hanks and the Miami Herald's David Neal joining us today. And again, you can find their reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. David, Doug, thanks so much.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks for having me.
And just as a note, again, 12,000, over 12,000 cases reported for today, even though that's a few thousand less of what we had for the record-breaking Sunday, still worse than the worst day New York had. Again, go to WLRN.org to keep up on all reporting on the coronavirus here in South Florida. Still to come, Fort Lauderdale removed its police chief last week. We're going to learn more about why and who replaced him. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Rick Maglione, who had been chief of the Fort Lauderdale Police Department since 2017, was removed from his position last week. Maglione faced scrutiny for his officer's actions during a protest in Fort Lauderdale back in May. LaToya Ratliff was hit in the eye by a rubber foam bullet and required dozens of stitches on her face. Another protester was pushed to the ground while kneeling. Now, Fort Lauderdale has a new leader, Assistant Police Chief Karen Dietrich, and she stepped into the role as an interim, and that was announced during a press conference last week.
In the coming days, we have a lot of work to do. We're going to be meeting with the unions. We're going to be meeting with community members. We're going to bring in some unconventional methods. We're going to look at a lot of our processes, and we're going to make some change. We're going to reorganize a lot of the inside of the department.
Let me bring in WLRN's Broward County reporter Katie Switalski joining us now. Katie, great to have you back.
Thanks, Lewis. It's good to be on.
So before we get into the story of the removal of Chief Maglione, remind us of who he was, how long he'd only been in that position a few years.
Yeah, so Chief Maglione has been chief since early 2017, but he's been with the department in Fort Lauderdale much longer than that. He's been there for 29 years. So this was a very known figure who's been around for a while.
So last week, the city removes him from his post, though he's still with the department, right? I mean, they didn't fire him.
Correct. So they've reassigned him. He doesn't have a new role yet, but the city has said he will remain with the department in some new position that's still to be determined.
What was the reason to remove him now?
And this was interesting. The city never said head on there was one reason. And so this was city manager Chris Lagerblum that was responsible for this decision and making this change. And when pressed upon this several times, he really wouldn't say there was one thing. There was a lot of emphasis from the city on needing a fresh perspective, needing fresh eyes, needing someone new to handle the department as we move into this period of change after the racial injustice protests. And so I think that had a lot to do with it. Another thing to remember is it wasn't, you mentioned, Lewis, some incidents at recent protests in Fort Lauderdale. But it was the communication that Chief Maglione had after these incidents, still defending the officers, that I think really caught a lot of attention, that maybe that didn't strike the right tone.
And they replaced it with Assistant Chief Karen Dietrich. Who is she?
She's been with the department for more than 30 years. So she's a longtime officer as well. And she's actually made history in the city. She was the first on the force for a woman in Fort Lauderdale to become a motorcycle officer. She's been a firearms instructor for more than 14 years, and she's got her own connections deeply rooted into the Broward County community. Both of her sons actually attended Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, and they were there on campus the day of the 2018 shooting. Now, her younger son was a freshman in the 1200 building where the shooting occurred, and her older son was in a different building, but she responded to that situation in totally different capacity. She was responding as the mom who hadn't heard from her kids. She was responding as a supervisor to responding officers and also a responding officer herself. And so, you know, she talks a lot about that in her bio and her profile with the police department. It's something that really, really shaped her.
There is a little something on her record that has popped up. There was a story about an issue with time cards. It was an internal investigation into timesheets that her and her husband had filled out. They were teaching courses, I think, at Broward College, and they were doing this while on duty. The investigation didn't find any wrongdoing, just bad record keeping, right?
Yes. So, and it's the Sun Sentinel that did really extensive reporting on this. And what they found were, in 2018, there were, just as you were saying, these double dipping accusations, and that, you know, that Dietrich and her husband were sort of double charging, right? They're salaried, but they were also getting paid by Broward College to teach classes at the police academy. And so the internal affairs investigation only looked at 2 years of this, and they did find 61 instances of this really bad record keeping for Dietrich and 13 instances of this for her husband. She was given a written reprimand. I think he was suspended one day. Yes, for one day without pay. And so it's really not known how much in these 2 years of extra compensation they received. But the review found it really wasn't anything wrong per se. The review looked at it more as just really bad record keeping.
Mm. There was mention, as we heard in the cut, that after the city relieved Maglione, that they would probably bring in an expert on police reform. What's the city promising here?
So right now, it's the city already has a citizen police review board. They are the ones that the city commission has charged with leading this discussion on reform and what should the Fort Lauderdale Police Department look like going forward. But the mayor has said they are going to bring in a national expert, a national consultant for this. There's really no timeline for that yet. They've just begun. And if anyone watched last week's city commission virtual meeting, online meeting, they began discussion about what they wanted for this, the city commissioners, of what they wanted this national consultant and citizens review board to look at. But they started that discussion at midnight last Tuesday. So not a lot of people were online to hear the discussion that late. But right now they're just saying this is what they want, but the actual practice of getting this has just begun.
And just to note, too, that, you know, Fort Lauderdale police, they have body cams in use. And in fact, body cam footage captured some of the conversations that Fort Lauderdale police had during the protest in May that garnered these controversies. Is there any update on the use of body cameras in the department? Is that something that's being talked about?
And yes. And what's being said around that is that the department needs to more regularly review their body camera footage. It was through records requests through the Miami Herald, the Sun Sentinel, that got this body cam footage to come to light. And some of the things the officers said about protesters, these all stemmed from a protest that kind of went south on May 31st and between protesters that had been peaceful and police, that the escalations rose. There was tear gas. This was when that protester was shot with a rubber bullet in the face and fractured her eye socket. This all happened at that one day. And so this body camera footage really captured officers seeming to revel and laugh and enjoy the firing back at protesters. And that's really criticized as a culture problem within the entire department. And so I think it was when Chief Maglione, after that happened, still defended his officers. You know, he told the Sun Sentinel, "We showed tremendous restraint." And then he told the Miami Herald, "The language may be offensive to some, but our officers were dealing with the chaos of a developing situation," sort of throwing what they said as maybe not mattering. And I think that's when people really started to realize, if we're going to change the culture of this department, we're going to change the leadership. And the decision last week was very unexpected. The news really kind of broke out of the blue that there was this change in leadership, but that these were some of the events leading up to that.
Again, we're talking with WLRN's Broward County reporter Katie Switalski. Fort Lauderdale's police chief Rick Maglione removed from his post last week, as she just mentioned. Now assistant police chief Karen Dietrich is the interim chief. We've invited her to join us on the program. We're still awaiting confirmation. And you could read more about these issues facing Fort Lauderdale's police department. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. So, Katie, what is Chief Dietrich, the interim chief, said about how she's gonna reorganize the department? She's gonna make changes.
She is, and we don't have a whole lot of specificity on that, but we have some. Knowing that these changes are gonna come, I wouldn't be surprised if there were more personnel shifts. But she's really said she's wanted to implement new and more training courses. So we don't know exactly what those training courses look like, but that's something that's really high up on her list. And she's also said that she's really excited about the idea of doing more de-escalation and conflict resolution sessions between officers and the department's in-house psychologist.
And we look at those two officers involved in that particular day in May at the protest. First, Officer Stephen Poherence, he was the one who was shoving a woman who was kneeling on the ground. What's happened to him so far?
He's actually been charged with first degree misdemeanor battery for this interaction by the Broward State Attorney Office. That is punishable by up to a year in jail. So he's been criminally charged for that interaction with the protester.
And then I believe it was the other one was Detective, and I say this name right, Eliezer Ramos. Is that the one who shot the rubber bullet at Latoya Ratliff?
Yes, that is the same officer. And you can see on the, that's where body camera footage really comes in and is useful and helpful to an observer, right? This Detective Ramos had said he was trying to shoot at someone behind Latoya. But you can see on the body camera footage, I mean, there's just such a huge, thick cloud of smoke and tear gas that it's really hard to see anything in that moment. So the specificity of aiming for someone behind the protester was called into question.
What has the union said about this move, about putting in a new chief?
Well, the president of the union has tried not to be specific about officers, but has said in a long Facebook video that he really feels like due process is what is right for these officers, and that there's been a lot of very quick to judge. And so he feels like these officers are being judged without the full due process of their review going through, and really wants to see that happen.
And, you know, again, Chief Dietrich is an interim. Is there any word as to whether or not they want to make that permanent, or is it just a just for now until they figure out what's next, maybe search for somebody?
Yep, it's just for now, because City Manager Chris Lagerblum, who is the decision maker on this, he came forward last Thursday when this all happened and said the search has begun immediately for a new police chief. So they are considering Chief Dietrich as this interim person to make some changes, help address some of these culture concerns in the department, and work with the Citizens Review Board to look at policy. And then, you know, that's all going on with the backdrop of a search going on behind the scenes.
Again, talking with WLRN's Broward County reporter Katie Switalski, and you can read more again about what's going on in Fort Lauderdale with their police department on our social media at WLRN Sundog. Katie, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come. The protests against police brutality were launched following the death of George Floyd, but a new social media project is bringing attention to lesser-known names of police violence here in South Florida. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Trayvon Martin. Their stories have been profiled by the national media and fueled discussions and policy changes to curb police violence against Black communities. But what about Damian Martin, James Leatherwood, Latasha Walton? Do you know their stories? The Instagram account Names You Don't Know is bringing those to light by sharing their local stories. Damian Martin was a 16-year-old boy in Sunrise, Florida. He died last March after being chased by police and running into a canal. Now, we spoke with his mother, Tequila Waters, and journalist Jess Swanson, who created the Names You Don't Know Instagram account. We did reach out to the Sunrise Police Department for comment about Martin's death while being pursued by police. We're going to include the full comment and the link to the internal investigation on our website at WLRN.org. Now, this is an excerpt of that conversation that happened last week. I wanted you to tell me a little bit about your son, Damian Martin, and what he was like, how you remember him, how family and friends remember him.
He was a beautiful child. Like, when I say a beautiful child, like, you can't just make up this. He was a beautiful child, always helping, like, always very humble, great athlete, great football player. He was a great big brother, great son, my firstborn son.
Jess, Damian's story was a turning point for you. Why?
I had covered local cases of police brutality in South Florida since, I think, 2015 with the Miami New Times. But Damian's story was the first time I started reporting from the very beginning. I attended his funeral, and I really quickly realized how hard Tequila was trying to get her son's case public national media attention.
Jess, I wanted to stay with you. What do we know about what happened that day when Damian died? What don't we know?
Basically, on Friday, March 9, 2019, there was teenagers in a car that was parked in Sunrise. Officers approached the car. According to the police report, one of the driver wasn't wearing a seatbelt. From accounts of passengers in the car, Damian was in the passenger seat, although police reports put him in the driver's seat, even though no DNA of his was found on the steering wheel or in the driver's, the gear shift. Officers approached the car. All the teenagers ran. Damian was an exceptional athlete. He ran very, very fast. The officers were not able to stop him. So he actually went to another street, and two more officers were called on the scene. They were the ones who stopped Damian. He was running towards the water, and as he was approaching the canal, Officer Terrence Walker with Sunrise Police deployed his taser. A taser, when it deploys, fires two probes. One probe didn't make contact, according to the police report. The second probe, there was a possible arcing motion, according to the police report. When crime scene investigators came to the scene later, they were never able to find the second probe. And then Damien goes in the water. He's swimming, trying to get away, but he very quickly starts to struggle. A security officer who was on the scene, who was just a civilian who witnessed this, said that Damien was calling for the officers to jump in and help them, but the officers stayed on the shore and they never jumped in. Damien ultimately goes under, and divers were called to retrieve the body. What we later find out was the taser was deployed. To anyone that knew Damien, he was an exceptional athlete. He taught his cousins how to swim. He was always in the water. No one in the family could make sense how he would drown. Very quickly, they said the story wasn't adding up when they came to me. And they said, we really believed he was tased, even though the police report said, even though the medical examiner's report said that there was no evidence of a taser wound. When we started reporting the story, we requested the images from the autopsy, and we got a second opinion from the John Jay School of Criminal Justice in New York. And their biomedical forensic anthropologist looked at the files, and very quickly she was able to find a wound that was a match for a taser wound. When we went back to the scene and looked at the records, we found that officers never found the second missing probe. It is the belief of the family that he was struck by a taser and that that second probe is in the water. Officers confirmed they never looked in the water for the probe. They went with metal detectors looking everywhere in the area for that second probe, but it was never uncovered. Sunrise Police disagrees with, they say that he was not, the taser never made contact. To that point, I always say that police officers, according to the Sunrise officers use of force manual, it's advised against deploying tasers against minors. Damien was 16. On top of that, it's advised not to be using them near bodies of water, which this case was, mm-hmm. and on elevated structures, which this case was. So regardless of the taser attaching to Damien or not, I don't think the officers were justified in their use of the taser. Ultimately, Sunrise Police did say that Officer Walker was justified in tasing Damien, who was a fleeing suspect and unarmed. At the time when he was recovered, is according to the autopsy, all he had in his pockets were his reading glasses and a $2 bill.
Jess, you started this Instagram account just last month. And I wondered what made you want to start this project?
So I've become very close with Tequila and her family, and I saw firsthand the grief. I mean, we've had many conversations where we would cry on the phone because this case is just so tragic. And I very quickly realized that this is just one. This is the tip of the iceberg. When I saw how Damien's case was reported, you know, the first story that came out was a teenager in a stolen car dies fleeing from police. And how very quickly people stop caring or listening because of these stereotypes that I think, you know, media has a duty to tell that other side of the story. And I think sometimes it can, you know, it's lazy and not lazy reporting to not get that other side. And I do think Tequila's story never got that other side, and how because of that, people just stopped caring. People wouldn't protest. His name wouldn't trend, despite how hard she tried to say how good of a kid he was, how innocent he was, how he'd never gotten in trouble before, how he had a scholarship. And it just nothing seemed to matter. Through that case, I learned about so many others. And when the George Floyd protest happened, I would go to the protests, and I would see activists holding signs that had the names of people in other cities. I would see Sandra Bland, I would see George Floyd, I would see Breonna Taylor, and I could tell these activists are well-meaning, but they don't know that there are so many names of people just in South Florida who have been killed by police. You know, Damien Martin is one out of over 100 names that I've compiled in the last few weeks of people who were killed by police in South Florida, starting with Reuben Stacy, I mean, who was lynched in 1935 on his way to jail. Police officers were holding him, and then a mob overpowered them, and he was lynched here in 1935 in Fort Lauderdale. He's buried less than a mile away from where Damien is buried. And I always thought that was such a poignant metaphor for the lack of justice that Black families have in South Florida.
I'm speaking with journalist Jess Swanson. She created an Instagram account highlighting the names of people in South Florida who've been killed by police violence. Also joining us is Tequila Waters. Her son, Damian Martin, died after a Sunrise police officer deployed his taser near the canal where he drowned. We've reached out to the City of Sunrise Police Department for a comment on Damian Martin's case. They ruled Martin's death an accidental drowning, maintaining that the electrified taser probes never made contact with him. We will post their full statement and the final internal affairs report online today. Ms. Waters, I wonder from you, you know, when you look at a project like this, why is it important for you that people know your son's name and his story, especially through social media?
I feel like no mother should have to go what I go through. I feel like no sister, brother, grandmother should have to go through what I have to go through. You understand? And I feel like he wasn't that kid. He was not that kid. When they told me that, I didn't believe it. I know for a fact it was a big lie because I know my son. I know how the humble person he is, and I want other people to know his name. I want him to just die in vain. Like, I want him to have justice. I want him to be heard. And I want to do anything and everything I could to make sure he's heard. They didn't know that he never got in trouble. They didn't know that his grades are on a roll. They never know him, you know? So they wasn't projecting him as that way. They was projecting him as another child, another black kid is out here doing wild things and in the streets with nobody that loved them, or no mothers, no parents, you know, like, and that wasn't the case with my son. That was never the case with him. But springtime, I want to give up, but I know I can't because my son didn't deserve for me to give up. You know, he deserved a fight. He deserved that chance.
I want to come back to this Instagram account and, you know, the power that it possesses. The way you set it up, you have these images of victims, and yet they're surrounded by these very colorful backgrounds. How did you choose the aesthetic for the account? How did you decide on that, Jess?
You know, when I was working in the Miami New Times, I remember reading about Darren Rainey. He was an inmate who was killed in Homestead in a shower because the water was so hot. The only images I would see of him were his mugshot. And I thought, how there's already this presumption of guilt when you see a mugshot photo. I don't think that's a dignified way to present someone who is a victim of police brutality. You know, there's something about seeing someone in a dignified way that makes people care in a way that words will never do. I just thought, how can I make these images in a way that will make people see them, humanize them, and honor them properly? And I quickly reached out to artists that I knew who volunteered their time to actually make illustrations of victims who do not have photos.
I want to talk about Damian's photo. And you have this beautiful photo of him. He's smiling. He's got his headphones. The background is so colorful. You know, these colorful flowers. Ms. Waters, tell me a little bit about that picture and why you chose that one, but also why, you know, the background for that. What did you want to tell the story with that?
He was full of life. He can walk into a dark room and make it shine with his smile alone. With his smile alone, he was full of life. Like, he was life. Like, my life ain't going to be the same. My kids' life ain't going to be the same because they took life.
That photo, I cropped his image. It was him at school with mm-hmm. his girlfriend at the time, Deja. They're sitting there listening to music together. And he's outside at school, and the greenery was the background. I've seen so many pictures of Damian. He has, so many photos over the last year, and he has the biggest, biggest smile. And I just wanted to make sure that people could see, he had this, he also had like a twinkle in his eye. I love mm-hmm. anecdotes from his family that they used to tell me how he was always yes, ma'am, no, ma'am.
Yeah.
he was such a charmer. He could smile his way out of trouble. Mm-hmm. He would look down and mm-hmm. I never met Damian, but through the family and their retellings, I feel very much that I know who he is.
Ms. Waters, when you look at those photos, the pictures on that Instagram account, what do you think about when you look at all of those photos?
It just brings like joy to my heart, like to know what he was, the kind of person he was. Like I said, he would tell you, he'll love you 100 times a day. Like, it was like, it reminded me of what I had, it reminded me of that. Like I still have that, you know, cause he's not here. He ain't gonna, oh God.
Ms. Waters, sadly, this has been happening for a long time. And yet now with the story of George Floyd, we see a movement that's gone global. I wonder from you, do you think that finally, you know, people, that the country's stopped to realize what's happened and this can't continue?
I have hope. I have hope. Like, things will change now, you know? I have hope, but I feel like it should have to come to another life, another this for, you know, to see what's going on. That's been going on for years, you know? This is something. So I feel pretty good about everything, about what's going on.
You know, Ms. Waters, I wondered, so now what kind of conversations are you having with your other kids about the police?
My little kids is terrified. I have twins, 7 years old, 6 year old, and a 5 year old, and also I have 11 year old. My kid is terrified of the police. When I say terrified, they see them, they run and cry. My little girl hide the other day. She seen the police officer. She ran and hide. I'm like, what are you hiding from? The police out there. I'm like, oh, my God, they're next door. They're not even there for, you know, like, they scared. They scared.
You know, one of the more powerful moments in the George Floyd case was at the end, and I think as Jess had mentioned, because it's on tape, it has more power. It's when he, at the end, he called out for his mother. And I'm wondering, as a mom, when you hear that, that's a grown man. That's a grown man. What goes through your head?
It broke me. I couldn't watch it because I know my son's last word was help, you know? And now I'm like, I don't know if it make me feel better, but like my son was scared. I could imagine like how scared he was. Like I couldn't imagine.
Ms. Waters, what is your son's legacy? How will he be remembered?
Through my heart, through my family, he's gonna be remembered. I'm gonna keep on speaking his name. I'm gonna keep on speaking Damien. Like, I'm not gonna stop. I remember his smile. I remember he telling me he loved me 100 times a day, helping me with his sisters and brothers. That day when he passed away, I was sick that day. So I got the kids ready and everything. And he was like kind of late for school. Like, Mom, I take him to school. He put their shoes and socks on and everything. He gave his sister them a hug. And I'm watching him. I'm like, look at him. He's always there for me. Because my husband had to work that day. He was out of town working. So he was always that kid. Like, I had to ask him to do anything. He was there. You know, as a kid. Like, you don't really have that in a kid these days. Like, it's hopeful. It's so full of life.
Yeah. No, again, I think of that image. I mean, it's a lovely image. He seems so happy in that picture. Jess, what's next for this project? What's next for this story?
Yeah, we are launching a online database archive with 100 different cases of police brutality. We're in the talks of starting a podcast, going and investigating each case at length. But yeah, this is definitely, you know, Damien's story is just one, the tip of the iceberg here in South Florida. Tequila is actually, her family's being represented by attorney Ben Crump, who is the attorney representing George Floyd's family. They're going to come forward with their intent to sue the Sunrise Police Department. It'll be announced very shortly. Mm-hmm.
So you heard from Tequila Waters. Her son Damien Martin died after a Sunrise police officer deployed his taser near the canal where he drowned. And you also heard journalist Jess Swanson, who created the Names You Don't Know Instagram account that highlights South Florida victims of police brutality. Now, Jess mentioned just now attorney Benjamin Crump's plans to sue the Sunrise Police Department. His law firm filed an intent to sue back in January. We reached out to Mr. Crump for comment about their plans for a lawsuit this July and have not yet received a response. And as we mentioned, the Sunrise Police Department provided a full statement regarding the circumstances of Damien Martin's death. Officer Luis Fernandez said they met with Mrs. Waters last year in April after the incident occurred, along with members of the Broward County Black Lives Matter organization. They spoke with Mrs. Waters about the details of the investigation available at that time. They also responded to multiple public information requests filed by Jessica Swanson, who was then working as a reporter for The Intercept. Jessica and Jason Fitzroy Jeffers produced a small documentary film about Damien's drowning and the subsequent protest. You can find a link to the film by going to WLRN.org later today. There will also be posted the full statement from the Sunrise Police Department. And that's our program for this Monday, July 13th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Affordable housing has long been a problem in South Florida, well before the start of the pandemic. Now, renters and homeowners out of work are facing evictions. Miami-Dade County released a new affordable housing framework to support those in need. We're going to learn about the county's actions and a new affordable housing development in Little Havana. Plus, Miami filmmakers are getting creative in quarantine. Close Quarters is a film festival that's happening online this Wednesday. All short films about how we're adapting to this new normal. We're going to hear about childbirth during COVID and battling rumors about the virus. And by the way, don't forget that we are reading Black Miami in the 20th Century by Dr. Marvin Dunn. Find us on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. We had to move back our interview with Dr. Dunn to this Friday. So if you have a question for the author, post it there. We'll ask him. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. Have a wonderful day. Be safe. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.